Welcome to the Digital Show Podcast. Every week, your hosts Kevin Werbach, Kartik Osanagar, and Lauren Feldman will talk with business leaders, entrepreneurs, policymakers, and experts about how technology is changing our world. From software to the internet to mobile, we explore the digital issues facing you and your organization. Here's this week's host.
Hi there, everyone. Thank you for joining us once again on The Digital Show, the show where we talk about technology and what it might mean for your business, what's happening in the world of internet startups, of major tech companies, and how is the internet continuing to change all of our lives. I'm this week's host, as you heard, Kevin Werbach. I'm a professor of legal studies and business ethics here at the Wharton School. Without further ado, let me introduce the first guest on the show. As I said, Sucharita Mulpuru is with Forrester Research. She's VP and Principal Analyst, a leading expert on e-commerce, multi-channel retail, consumer behavior, and trends in the online shopping space. So, Sucharita, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
So, as I said, the hook for doing this talk today is that it is Cyber Monday. So tell us, for someone in the e-commerce world, what the heck is Cyber Monday and where did it come from?
So Cyber Monday is actually the biggest shopping day for the online shopping world in the United States. There are other days like Singles Day that are huge in China, but in the United States and in a few other countries too, like the United Kingdom, Cyber Monday is just a huge shopping day. There are lots and lots of sales on virtually every site that you visit, and it actually started as a charity occasion. It was intended to be a way for retailers to actually provide for charitable contributions to a cause that the National Retail Federation had launched many years ago. But it has since morphed into a pretty commercial day.
Now that we're in a world where everyone, or most people at least, have fast broadband at home, and very large percentage of people have smartphones, and e-commerce is something that happens year-round, why is it that the online shopping numbers still spike now a couple days after Thanksgiving?
Well, I think at this point it has become, kind of its own beast, and it is a day that people know they'll find great bargains. Retailers put out great bargains, and it's a flywheel that feeds on itself. And it's just become a day unto itself, not unlike Black Friday, where people know that there are great deals and they go hunting around anticipating that they may be able to find great deals. A significant part of shopping that happens on this day and Thanksgiving is actually shopping for self. It's not gift shopping. So what that means is that there's a lot of delay of gratification, so to speak, where you have your eye on something for a number of months, and you're waiting to see if it's finally at a price point or at an offer that that you're willing to pony up to buy.
So Black Friday, the day after Thanksgiving, is still the classic go into a retail store and fight for the bargains, and Cyber Monday now is entrenched as this kind of online buy for yourself time.
Well, it's interesting this year about Black Friday is that the sales in physical stores actually went down, which is very unusual for any big sale day, because consumers, especially Americans, love sales. And they at worst, it'll be like anemic growth, but at least it'll be growth. This year in physical stores, we saw collective.
So, Sucharita, thank you so much for coming on. It's been great talking with you, and happy Cyber Monday.
Thank you, Kevin. Appreciate your time.
My next guest is Danny Sullivan. He's the founding editor of Marketing Land and Search Engine Land. He's been writing about search engine and internet marketing for nearly 20 years, really a legend in that world. Is, as I said, the founding editor of those two publications, and also produces the SMX and MarTech conferences. So, Danny, delighted to have you. Thanks for coming on the show.
You're welcome. It's nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
So what caught my eye was something that you wrote about this concept of app streaming, Google's new app streaming technology. And this struck me as something that sounds insignificant. It's not something that was terribly widely reported, but could really be a big deal down the road. So tell us a little bit about what Google's app streaming is and why you thought it was something interesting to cover.
Sure. Basically, what it does is it allows you to do a search. This is when you're on your mobile phone, and you have to have a number of things set up. You have to be on Wi-Fi with a good connection, and it only works with the Google app. But assuming you've got all those things set up that you need to have, you can do a search, and if they find content that's within an app, say a listing, one of the examples they had was Hotel Tonight, when you click on that, it will take you right into the Hotel Tonight app. But you don't have to have the app installed. It'll literally stream or broadcast that app through the app, the Google app itself, as if you had it. So there's no need to download an app to get at that sort of content. And it sounds like a very simple thing, you know, to do, but anybody who's ever tried to get to content that's within an app and then be told, oh, you need to install this app, and you go to the App Store and you have to wait for it to download and go through all that rigmarole, then you start to understand this is actually a very useful thing.
Yeah, so what's different about getting the experience of the app versus the web link you would get otherwise?
So the key difference is that, and to step back a bit, is that there are some apps that have content that you can only see if you are in the app itself. So if you're on a mobile browser and you're just searching without this technology that Google's doing, you won't find any of the information that's within Hotel Tonight because they don't actually have a website. You know, all their information is only within the app. So if you don't have the app, you can't get to the stuff that they have that's available. So when you do your searches, you just don't see it. All that content is effectively invisible to Google, and therefore it's not going to show up in Google search results. And then for a searcher, it means that potentially there's useful information you want that you won't find because Google can't see it. With the technology, they're effectively able to go inside the app, find, if you will, all the pages that are inside the app in the way that a website might have pages, and give you links from Google search results directly into the web, into the app itself, and into those individual pages that are within the app. So that now this content that was effectively invisible, that Google had no ability to know about, is visible to Google, can be surfaced when it makes sense for search results, and people can view it without having to do any kind of an installation of the app itself to understand what's going on there.
Why is it such a big deal to just go and, you know, click on the app or click on the little install button in the app?
It's much, much faster. Mm-hmm. You know, if apps usually are going to take you a minute to 2 minutes or longer to download. You have to install. You may be asked to do a login situation, you know, all to discover that maybe you're not that interested in the content in the end. Or maybe you are interested, like the news app might have some content that's within it, but it's a lot of work to go through just to read a news article that might be on the web itself. And lastly, there may be content that's out there that you don't need the app on a regular basis. You know, there are thousands of apps, and you may only need to read this one particular content or look at this particular information once. And so it's a lot of effort and a lot of litter, if you will, on your mobile device to be installing these apps for some of these one-time uses, even though the information may be really useful on that one-time basis. So with the app streaming, it's kind of like being able to flip to a channel on, you know, your cable or satellite that you don't always watch it, but it's nice to have it there if the occasional thing that comes up.
Yeah, so when I first read this, my immediate reaction was, isn't this like the battle a few years ago between apps and HTML5, where you had the debate over whether the mobile experience would be in all these standalone apps versus coding it in a version of HTML that allowed a lot of the richness of apps, but still on a standards-based kind of web environment. And Facebook famously said, the world's going to be HTML5, invested a lot of resources in it, and then eventually turned around, admitted failure, and said, no, it's an app world on mobile. So how is this kind of vision of streaming apps different from that HTML5 version, which for whatever reason didn't really take hold?
Well, For content that's HTML5, it probably will have both an app and a web page equivalent. So there's nothing that's sort of invisible. And Facebook's an excellent example of that. Facebook uses a technology with Google, you know, called deep linking. And so if you do a search, you can click on Google search results, and it will take you to a web page at Facebook with the content you're looking for if you don't have the app installed. But if you do have the app installed, Google can tell that and then jump you right into the app. But it's like a one-to-one connection. The same stuff you see on the web will be the same stuff you see on the app. So the difference with this is it's for the people who, or the publishers who've decided, we aren't even messing with the web. You know, we think the future is all about the app, so we're only building apps. We don't even have websites. And, you know, for those people, it really is a case of HTML5 doesn't cut it because they don't even have it at all. Mm. Now, there's an argument that they may be making a mistake, right? Hotel Tonight started out as a mobile application. They may feel like that's perfectly fine. It's going well for them. But there's a very strong argument that you probably ought to have a website as well, because it's great that Google's doing all this stuff and it's going to help you in some ways, but you're not actually being competitive with the people who are on the mobile web who may not be in a position to do all this kind of streaming. So that's one thing to consider. But the other issue where I think it's coming more into play is for the developing world, where they really are mobile apps, and it just might even be that they're not going to build the websites because many places just don't even have websites now. They do have the mobile apps. So it's a lot about Google trying to make sure they're able to keep up with what people are doing and kind of covering the bases, you know, that maybe HTML5 will still win. And, you know, at some point, you have to ask, is it really going to be that every single person has to have an app? We have to download an app for everything that's out there? That seems kind of far-fetched. But if more important things are growing, then this gives them some coverage in that regard.
So, Danny Sullivan, thanks a lot. Great to have you on the show. And as I said, we'll follow along and hopefully have you back on sometime.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Live with me in the studio, Al Filreis, the Kelly Professor of English here at the University of Pennsylvania. He's also the faculty director of the Kelly Writers House, which is an extraordinary resource that we have here on campus. But Al is also one of the pioneers in online teaching as the creator of one of the first massive open online courses at Penn around the same time that I started a MOOC. And so, Al, thanks for coming on the show.
Kevin, thank you so much.
So you've been teaching your MOOC four times now, ModPo on modern poetry. Can you sum up so far what your biggest takeaway has been?
The massive open online courses in 2012 were new, but here's how they weren't new. And I think we discovered this, and I'm dying to hear what you think about this. Learners are learners. They still stumble over the same sorts of things. If you give confusing information or confusing instructions to 30 people or 100 people, you'll get about 15 of them daring to tell you. If you give the same confusing instructions to 20,000 or 30,000 or 60,000, you'll get thousands of people telling you that they're confusing. It's the same problem of teaching, bad teaching. I think what it means is that we, or at least I'll speak for myself, I became super self-conscious, pedagogical self-consciousness, or meta-pedagogy, not just teaching, but trying to teach with the problem of teaching always forefront in my mind. And I think a lot of teachers have fallen into a pattern, teachers at all levels, not just at the college or university, we've fallen into a pattern where we teach the material and we think the material will teach itself, and then our enthusiasm will overcome any kind of glitches in the way we've planned the course. Glitches in a massive open online course will be exposed completely and immediately. So I think it has the potential, and certainly did when we first tried it, to create better courses on campus, courses that are actually aligned with our pedagogical goals, rather than simply we hope that we're reaching some kind of goal, and then maybe in the evaluations we do, And a lot of students can look us in the face and they realize we have certain institutional authority and they'll forgive us for our lack of organization in the course. So just from the education side, and I'm not really an ed guy, and I don't think you are either, you know, just strictly from the education side, this thing has forced us all to think clearly about how we teach.
Yeah, I think that's really true. Those of us who have done it, it really does force you to consider the impact of all the decisions that you make. Absolutely. And I probably should step back because we're assuming here I'm throwing around this term like
yeah,
MOOC
we should
that
define
people
it.
Know
Let's
what it is.
It. Yeah.
So well, I'll take my stab
you
and you
first,
can tell me if
yeah,
I got it right.
Great,
this will be a test, right?
Okay,
So MOOC is Massive Open Online Course. Courses delivered online designed for massive scale. So these are typically classes that have thousands, tens of thousands, in some cases hundreds of thousands of students enrolled in the course at once. The typical model, and then this will get to you describing how you've gone off of the typical model, is a series of short videos. So you see the professor giving a lecture on these various little, often 5-10 minute video segments, mixed in with assignments, quizzes, other kinds of assessments, and discussion forums, and other ways for the students to get information. And then the students go through and watch the videos, study for the tests, pass the test, get a certificate, and they can do it at home, you know, to some extent on their own time.
Everything you described is right, and we could have technologically or technically done this in 1999. The problem with this definition is that it assumes it's essentially a one-way channel like the one we're using right now. Although if someone were to call in to this show right now, it would become no longer a one-way channel. And that was never part of the definition of a massive open online course by most purveyors in 2012. And here's my problem with it. If radio, that old medium,
yep,
could do two-way or multi-way, you could have a conversation with three or four people calling in at once. The people in the control room here could handle that. You could also bring in recordings of people asking you questions and so forth. That interactivity is in radio, but it was presumably not.
As with so many other things online, we always start with this notion that sort of there's the virtual world and the physical world and never the twain shall meet. And then the reality is these things overlap. So it's like, you know, just like, you know, it's not just like e-commerce and physical commerce. It's not just, you know, content online and offline. You know, we're all living in the virtual world at the same time as we live in the physical world. We got to get to a point where it's like, okay, let's take what works from this technology, take what works from various kinds of real world interactions, which might be, you know, a student enrolled in a college on a campus, and it might be someone in a Starbucks with a couple friends in, you know, Bangkok or wherever they are, and just figure out the different things that work.
There are human beings on all sides of this. And let me just tell one final story. So there's a student named Sharon Ingraham who's from Western Canada. She's been in ModPOF all 4 years. I simply know her by her initials, S.E. Ingraham. She's in there. She's tremendous. I don't know anything about her. She's just been really terrific. She'd been telling her husband about this course and about this guy Al and all these great people and the Kelly Writers House at Penn. And, you know, she's somewhere else. So she finally convinces, he finally says, look, all right, let's take a ModPO road trip. So this fall, with her fourth time in the class, they got in a car and they drove from Canada first down to Washington, D.C., where they met a kind of ModPO famous Saturday meetup at a bookstore. I think it's Politics and Prose or something like that. They met the D.C. gang. Then I was doing an on-the-road ModPO live webcast in New York. So the next stop was New York, where I met her. The next stop was the Kelly Writers House here at Penn. And then she went on somewhere else and met some other people. Chicago, I think, actually, and did a Chicago meetup, I think. So she had four stops. Her husband was great. He was very tolerant. This was her thing. They're both retired. She's extremely, extremely smart. She's never been traditionally educated in this field. And I got to meet her, and she was a human being, of course. And she was a colleague. She was a student. She was a partner. She was a collaborator. I don't know what she is, but she loves the Writers House. She loves the course. She's fully conversant with it. She felt completely at home at the University of Pennsylvania. I gave her a big hug, though I'd known her for 4 years and never met her. This is nothing more than what we've gotten since the internet came about, which is we can meet people who can become friends and co-learners, and then they're in our space, just like a traditional student. So she sits in on a course at the University of Pennsylvania. She's not paying tuition, but she feels fully conversant mm-hmm. in the topics. And it seems to me, for my students who are homogeneously generational, homogeneously national, and homogeneously class-based, they can benefit from a diversity of people who are talking about the same poems and realize that the world is interested in this.
Appreciate you coming into the studio.
My pleasure, completely. Thank you, Kevin.
As this world continues to unfolding, I'd love to have you back, and we'll see where things go.
I'd be happy to come back.
Yeah, Al Filreis, great to have you on the show.
Thank you.
My last guest is Howard Greenstein. He's the COO of DomainScate. He's been a marketing strategist, technology strategist, and many other things for a wide variety of companies and organizations in New York for a number of years. One of the influential figures in the New York technology scene. Howard, glad to have you on.
Thanks for having me, Kevin. Good afternoon.
So tell us about DomainScate. I sort of teased people at the beginning that it was something at the intersection of marketing and cybersecurity, which to me always sort of sounds kind of odd when you hear it put together, but makes sense when I understood what you were doing.
Well, that's true. It's kind of brand security. We're talking about protecting your brand online. And we're not talking about antivirus or Norton or firewalls or things like that. These are the things that affect the CFO, that affect the CMO, that can be reputationally damaging to your business. And what the company is doing was founded by an intellectual property attorney who was advising many large brands about the challenges they were facing with cyber fraud, brand fraud, people taking specifically domains and using them to fool customers, fool employees, and effectively lose business. They'd lose business because of some of these challenges. And so he got together with me, and we put together this company that is really starting to help. I mean, it's not, we're not the only people who have ever done, you know, the concept of looking for domains, but we're really trying to be that tool that's not necessarily for the cybersecurity professional, but more for the marketing and business professionals.
So I'm sure most people that are listening are familiar with hacking and the various examples where systems are breached and private information becomes available. Why are domain names potentially a security risk for companies?
It's a great question. And the biggest challenge is that most people trust that when they type in a name online, whether it's on their phone or on their desktop computer or tablet, wherever they're going, they're going to get to the site that they expect. And in fact, one of my teammates told me this story this weekend. She was looking for a winter coat. It's starting to get to be pretty cold up here in the Northeast. And she was looking for a coat, and someone sent her a deal on a particular brand of coats that she's been looking for, and they're typically pretty expensive. And when she went to the site, it was a one-letter-off site. So this actually happened to one of our teammates. It was not the actual brand. We don't know if they were knockoffs or whether they were just trying to steal her credit card and trying to offer her what looked like a real product. But by not, by going to the site, she could have been fooled. She could have lost credit card information. She could have, had an identity theft problem. And this is a brand issue, and it was just one letter off on the domain. It looked like an O, but it was actually a zero. And this kind of thing is starting to happen. In fact, the FBI calls something that's happening with this the business email compromise. They attribute $275 million of loss to people getting emails that look like they come from a legitimate source. The domain name may be slightly off from the actual business. People will then follow the instructions in the email, doing things as crazy as transferring money overseas because they got an email that looked legitimate from what looked like someone in the company.
So it's all the fact that the bad guys have come up with a ability to get a domain name that looks sufficiently close to the legitimate one that causes people to trust them.
It's the legitimately close, or even as of this year, there are new domains. There are over 790 new domains, some of which are really great and are being used for great purposes. There are great examples of things in .nyc, .club, .xyz, where people are using and creating new and unique domain names that have some positive things, and happy to talk about that. But some of these domains that are coming out are also being used to fool people. A great example, this summer, somebody took the name Bloomberg.market and put up a fake Bloomberg news site, and they put up a news story on it that was fake, saying that Twitter was for sale for $31 billion. And it actually moved the market significantly in Twitter, several points up, several points down within a couple of minutes, because the news traveled and then it went away. And this is the subject of an FBI investigation, as far as we understand, because it was a fake site that put out fake news that materially affected a market traded stock.
So I would think a lot of people would hear that and ask the question, well, how is it that someone could just go that's not either Michael Bloomberg or his eponymous company,
right,
and set up a domain name, Bloomberg.market?
Well, that's a great question. And the challenge is that pretty much anyone can register almost any site. When we do work for companies, and we do work with companies that are small and mid-sized, as well as some very large enterprises, we find typically either mistypes or even exact brand names with different domain extensions registered all over the place. And there is very little that keeps that from happening. When ICANN, the organization that sets up the domain name naming system, put together this program to expand the domain space, they said, well, we're going to put together a database called the Trademark Clearinghouse. And if you have a trademark, a registered trademark, you can put your name in. And what that'll do is you get first right to go and get your name in some of these domains. And then after that, people will be notified if they try to register the exact trademark name. But it doesn't prevent them from registering that name. And so people would go and grab the names that they wanted. But it's really tough to be, you know, having a strategy of defensive registration when you have 790 places that you have to register. It starts to get expensive. Only the richest companies can really pull that off.
All right. So that gets us back to DomainScape. So talk about how you address this problem, what kind of information you're able to provide to companies.
Well, that's a really important question. The information that we're providing, we're going out there, we're searching over 200 million domain names every day. And what we come back with is sites that are exact matches to your name, as well as sites that are variations. And we also provide screenshots so you see how the site is being used, whether it's parked at a registrar, for example, whether there's no site there actually existing right now, or whether there's a site there that, hey, that looks a lot like my site, and we better investigate that immediately. We also check for things like, is this site serving malware? Or is this site involved in a phishing scam that we're aware of? And in fact, a major hotel chain, if you were to type one letter off, it will try to give you a new flash player. And what that really is code for is, hey, we're going to try to infect your computer.
Great. Thanks a lot, Howard. Great to have you on the show.
Thanks.
This has been the Digital Show Podcast. To find out more about the Digital Show, visit our site at digitalshow111.com or follow us on Twitter @digitalshow111. We'll be back again next week. Thanks for listening.